Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Strantz, live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at DunbarLumber.com. Going to be joined by Brendan Batchelor here momentarily, fresh off of tweeting the lines from Canucks practice today at Rogers Arena. In fact, now joining us, he is the voice of the Vancouver Canucks here on Sportsnet 650, Brendan Batchelor. What's going on, Batch?
Not much. How's it going?
It's going well. Lots to get into from last night, and we haven't had a chance even to pass along your, as I said, it's a fresh off, hot off the presses tweet, lines tweet for you from Canucks practice. So we haven't really even had a chance to pass it along to our listeners, but if I'm reading it correctly, basically the only change we're seeing is Hoglander getting bumped down to the fourth line and Arshdeep Bains taking his spot, and then Noah Juulsen taking Vincent Desharnais' spot on the third defense pairing. Does that match what you're seeing?
Yes. So the forward lines are the way that they finished last night, where Hoglander was moved off that line in game and Bains was elevated. And we did actually see the defensive pairings tweaked in the third period, which I thought was interesting, where Brännström and Myers were playing together late and Soucy wasn't out with Myers quite as often. But yeah, it looks like Juulsen will come in for Desharnais based on the way they're skating today, and we'll see whether these lines stick as they go into the game against the Devils tomorrow.
Do you think it was just the back check on that second Carolina goal that cost Hoglander?
Maybe. It's certainly a factor, although I was sort of tracking that his game was kind of trending in the wrong direction over the last few. He hadn't been contributing as much on the score sheet, which isn't the be-all and end-all for a guy like Hoglander, generally speaking, but when you're on a line with Elias Pettersson, when you're on a line with Connor Garland, there's going to be more expectation of bottom line, and we hadn't seen as much of that from Hoglander recently. So if he was scoring and had a big mistake like that on a goal against, then you know maybe the coaching staff would be more willing to let it slide, but his production's been down over the last handful of games. And you have a big defensive miscue like that, and it doesn't surprise me that a message is being sent to him both late in the game last night and into practice today.
Batch, we've talked a lot about like the non-Hughes minutes as a concept, right? But we haven't talked much about, for example, what is happening with Vancouver's second pair. What are you seeing from Soucy Myers right now? Like, why does it look different from a defensive solidity standpoint than it did last year?
Yeah, I don't know if it's just like you can just put it down to it's early in the season and they're not dialed in on their details yet, both as a five-man unit and as a defensive pairing, but it's looked looser in the defensive zone. It hasn't looked as sort of solid as those two guys looked together last year down the stretch and into the playoffs. And we've heard Rick Tocchet talk a lot about defending the middle of the ice, and you know, as a team, they're not doing that as well. And I think when those guys are on the ice, that's evident too. So, you know, I don't know. Like, is there anything notable that you're seeing from that pairing that I'm maybe not picking up on here? But I just, you know, they don't seem as dialed in maybe as they were down the stretch last year. And to a certain extent, I would imagine that's expected at some level for all players. It's why games are more high scoring and there's more loose play early in the season in general. But, you know, whether that's something those guys can dial in or whether it's going to be a problem for them going forward, I think is going to be really interesting to track.
I think what I'm seeing more than anything is, you know, not that Soucy has ever been an elite puck mover or anything, but just it seems like it's a lot more labored for him handling the puck, skating with the puck, all of it. Like, he's just really fighting things, not making crisp passes. And again, he's not Quinn Hughes or anything like that, but there was a certain level I think we were expecting from him that he showed he could hit last year. And so far, we just haven't really seen that from him or Myers on that pairing.
Yeah, and, you know, when I talk about Brännström being moved there last night, like to a certain extent, I think that was situational because you're chasing the game and Brännström profiles more offensively than Soucy as a defenseman.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, he has definitely been the better puck mover of the two at this point to start the year. And I know he's a guy that was sort of a throw in a cap dump trade, but with the way he's played this far, or thus far, I should say, he's making a solid campaign for more minutes. And if he, you know, is elected in that campaign at this time of the year, we could use a political election campaign analogy with everything that's happening both in our province and south of the border. You know, he stands to win at the expense of Carson Soucy if he's going to be elevated up the lineup and keep playing consistently. And it's that profile of puck moving ability, of being willing to, you know, transition it north quickly and doing that very effectively. And we've seen the impact that Branstrom has had in terms of some of that counterattacking ability, you know, really helping generate some of their rush looks, which you can't necessarily say about Soucy. That, you know, may sort of give some credence to that conversation and will be interesting to track going forward.
So looking at that result last night, Batch, and it's a very interesting one for me, right? Because I thought they were pretty soundly outclassed for much of the game, but hey, then they were able to generate a lot of dangerous scoring chances. They come back, they tie the game, they get a point against a very good team in Carolina. After the game, Rick Tocchet seemed pretty frustrated, had some fairly pointed criticism, also stopped himself short of maybe offering some more pointed criticism after the game. For you, what kind of stands out as the biggest red flag in the Canucks' performance from last night?
Yeah, well, I think what Tocchet was talking about after the game, where he was saying, you know, we've been telling them for days about the way Carolina was going to play and about what we needed to do to have success, and they still seemed caught off guard by the intensity and the high pressure and the way that the Hurricanes play. And look, Carolina's a very good team. They're really dialed in on their system. Rod Brind'Amour has them playing exactly the way that he wants them to play, and he's had a lot longer to work with the main group of guys on that team than Rick Tocchet has had with this group of Canucks. So, you know, to a certain extent, I wasn't surprised at how well Carolina played, but for a guy that has talked about raising the bar, that wants his team to play in a very similar manner to how the Hurricanes played last night and the way they were able to generate off the rush, especially when, you know, he's talked about preparing his group for the intensity they're going to come with, for the forecheck they're going to bring, for, you know, the ability that you'll have to beat them if you can use the space behind them to generate your own odd man rushes, which we did see the Canucks do in stretches last night. That, to me, is maybe the more concerning thing than anything else, rather than, you know, the individual criticism of Hoglander or of the power play. The fact that, you know, he feels like they had a game plan in place that would have allowed them to have success, and it was a lack of execution. Now, is my, you know, worryometer, to use a reach term, at like an 8 or 9 out of 10? No, it's not, because we're still in October, and these are things that this group is going to have to dial in. But if we're hearing from Rick Tocchet in February or March or April, and he's still talking about, you know, lack of execution of the plan and the systems that he wants this group to play, then that's a much more worrying thing, because, you know, you expect your team to improve in this regard going forward throughout the year. And I should mention here, as I'm watching practice, Tocchet did make a pretty pointed comment about making changes to the power play after the game last night, but at least in the practice right now, it doesn't look like there are any marked changes in terms of deployment. Connor Garland is still on the top power play unit. DeBrusque still on the second unit. So, you know, the changes may be more in terms of structure, in terms of execution, in terms of what they want to do on the power play, but it doesn't look right now anyway like those changes are going to involve personnel.
Batch, the Canucks are dead last in the NHL in terms of the rate at which they are generating shot attempts 5-on-4. Just not getting set up efficiently. What catches your eye puck watching when you're watching Vancouver with the man advantage right now?
Entries.
Yeah.
Like they can't get in the zone, and you can't generate shots if you're not in the zone. That's something that's been a real struggle for them. I think it might be a big part of the reason why they put Garland on the top unit, because he is a guy that can be effective at gaining the zone, but teams just stack up guys along that blue line, and the Canucks often, like, one guy will skate into a crowd of three or four guys, try to make a play, have it picked off, the puck's back down the ice, and there goes 25 to 30 seconds of your power play blown on a missed entry. So, you know, aside from all the end zone stuff that we can talk about, where at times they look static, and Rick Tocchet talks about they need to be less formulaic and get pucks to the net and have more of that killer instinct, I think all of those things are true as well, but we haven't seen enough of their end zone work because they're not getting into the zone and not getting set up with enough regularity to be able to execute. And, you know, I think they have a chance to be better in those areas if they can have sustained stretches where they are set up in the zone. You know, it's going back right to the start of the season, but we saw them set up a nice power play goal where DeBrusque and Besser switched in their rotation so that Besser was the guy in the slot and DeBrusque was down at the side of the goal and set him up for a one-timer in the middle of the ice. And it's those kinds of rotations and movement that I think they need to find more of in their in-zone power play. But if you can't get set up in the zone, then you can't get shots, you can't create chances, you can't create those sorts of looks. So I don't know if they need to sort of go back to the drawing board in terms of how they want to gain zone entries, but that to me is the biggest, most glaring issue in terms of why the power play is struggling at the moment.
It's such a bizarre thing, too, because you look at the personnel available to them, and I mean, we were, you know, talking about the incredible impact Quinn Hughes is having on the early going here, and if you're trying to, you know, pick players from the NHL who can help you gain the zone, Quinn Hughes would be pretty high on that list, right? Like, JT Miller should be effective at that. Elias Pettersson, when he's been on his game, has been really, really good at that, and yet for some reason, that collection of talent just can't figure out how to do it consistently right now. It's pretty bizarre to watch on a nightly basis. Go ahead.
There's a good point to be made there quickly, which is that the way they're doing things right now, the puck isn't in Hughes' hands very often for the zone entries, right? Like, he's the guy that brings it up, and then he drops it to Pettersson and or Garland trailing. And they try to do that thing where they both drive separate lanes and pass back and forth to get the defense moving and gain the zone. But that, I think, has been pretty well scouted now by oppositions, and it's not effective. So, like, we know how much Quinn Hughes can be a zone exit and zone entry machine. I would just say give him the puck, let him gain the zone, let him make a play if he doesn't have anything to find someone else in space that can gain the zone, and then go from there. But right now they don't have the puck in number 43's hands very often on those zone entries, and I would change that personally if it was me making the call, although it's probably a good thing that it's not.
Indeed. The other guy I wanted to ask you about, Batch, is Jake DeBrusque, who, of course, you know, look, Pettersson is most under the microscope here right now, the most conversation and attention being paid to him, but Jake DeBrusque might be second at the moment as a big free agent signing who has yet to score a goal. Started to see some frustration in his game last night, I thought. You know, he gets victimized on that 3-on-2, but I'll give him a bit of a pass on that one. He's a forward back defending in that situation. But, you know, Rick Tocchet has been open to, like, hey, DeBrusque is still kind of trying to find his identity, where he fits on the team. What's standing out to you about DeBrusque's game right now?
Yeah, I don't have as much concern about DeBrusque as some people might, because I think he's still getting some of those chances. And he talked about this after the game last night, that, you know, he had the really good forehand deke chance in the game yesterday that Kochetkov got him on with the pad and the poke check, where, you know, he said, you know, I'm getting those looks, I'm getting those opportunities, I just need one to go in, and then, you know, things will open up a little bit. And, you know, this is also a guy that's on a new team with new line mates trying to figure things out. And Landon Ferraro talked about this with us on the pregame show the other day before the game against Pittsburgh, where when you're with a new team, like, it's not just a new city, a new place you're living, but, like, everywhere you look, everything that you're going through is new. You look to your left on the ice, it's a new guy. You look to your right on the ice, it's a new guy. You're in the dressing room, a different guy sitting next to you. There's a whole different routine that you have to get in. And I think part of the reason, not just with DeBrusque, but with the overall team game, that we've seen things maybe be a little bit slower than they would like to start the season is because of the number of new faces they have. So I'm willing to give DeBrusque some more time. I think he's had some looks. I think it's probably only a matter of time till he puts the puck in the back of the net. And when he does, I think that'll lift a weight off his shoulders and he'll be able to play a little bit more freely and have some more success. So, you know, is it great that it's, what, 8 games now and he hasn't scored a goal? No, yeah. It's not. He's your big free agent signing top 6 winger that you want to be able to put the puck in the back of the net. And he's also been removed from power play 1. So those are both, you know, concerning things for me, but they're lowercase c concerning rather than in capital letters and in bold font right now.
Batch, when you think about last night, do you sort of view it as the Canucks being fortunate to get a point, or did you view it as a solid team-level performance?
A fortunate to get a point, for sure. I think, you know, the way Tocchet put it, he said that they had a good 10 minutes at the end of the game, and this is a team that has done that. It's almost become part of their identity, where on nights they don't play well, they find a way to be resilient and get late goals and have a good late flurry to salvage a point or find a way to win. But I think the obvious follow-up question to that is, why are you waiting for the last 10 minutes to do that? Why can't you start a game like that? Why can't you play like that more consistently so that instead of chasing games and needing that, you know, level of desperation to get into games, you're the team that starts that way. You're the team that builds the lead. You're the team that then can sit back and protect rather than having to play that desperate hockey. And hey, you know, it's a great thing for them that they can pull rabbits out of hats in those situations, and it definitely stood them in good stead in the playoffs last year. But it's not something that you can rely on as a team, because eventually your luck will run out and, you know, you'll reach into the top hat and the rabbit won't be there. And you don't want that to be in a critical moment or in a crucial winner-take-all playoff game. And perfect example was Game 7 yeah. against the Oilers last year, where they had that great push and they were right there at the end, but ultimately they fell too short. And, you know, that can't happen. That can't be the way that this team tries to get wins and play consistently, because it is not a recipe for success over a larger sample size.
Batch, appreciate it. We'll let you get back to practice and do your job, and rather than chatting with us. But thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Sounds good. Thanks, boys.
That is Brendan Batchelor, voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650.
Reporting live from Canucks practice, where the promise of change on the power play has not delivered, although...
Well, he didn't explicitly say personnel change, right? So as Batch said, it could be more like what those five guys are doing on the ice rather than changing the guys who are out there.
Right. Okay.
So it could still be change. It's just not personnel change.
It needs to, man.
Something needs to change in a big way.
Yeah.
There's no way, even if it's not an elite power play, right? But there is no way that group of players, Pettersson struggles included, Miller not being at full health included, still, that group of players should not be dead last in shot rate on the power play by a significant margin.
Shot attempt rate.
But yeah, still, there's no way that should be the status quo.
45 minutes with the man advantage, okay? 57 shot attempts, 28 shots. It's tough, man.
Yeah.
It's tough. They've also allowed 8 scoring chances against.
Well, and I think it's there's been a lot of power plays where the best chance goes to the other team.
Lots of games like last night, the best chances on the Canucks power play were Carolina's, but with a bullet.
Yeah. And it stands out, I think, also because it's the one area of the team's game right now where Quinn Hughes isn't like the answer. He's not, you know, the fixer on it, right? Because he's part of it. Well, and I'm not saying it's his fault or anything, but there's so many other situations where it's like, we need this to be better. It's like, we'll throw Quinn Hughes at it and it'll be better. And that's not the case for the power play right now.
You also want to understand why Quinn Hughes is, you know, trailing so significantly
in the Norris. The
power play's not working. Yep. So he's not getting those points, right? He's not getting those secondary assists and, you know, the popcorn stuff. Why is the criticism of Pettersson at such a fever pitch? Power play's not working. It's not helping insulate him, right? I mean, there's a lot of things that you'd feel better about or that would look better superficially about how this team's performing on an individual level if the power play was just sort of functioning, you know, even at like the 22%-ish clip that this club has seemed to sustain. But obviously you want it to be even better than that given the talent of the players involved.
By the way, speaking of Quinn Hughes, and we can get more into the power play later, and maybe we'll see. Hopefully we get a chance to hear from Rick Tocchet before the show's over today. But speaking of Quinn Hughes and, you know, the whole idea of the non-Hughes minutes, I was just looking this up while we had Batch on the line there. Shot attempt share. There is one player above 50% on the Canucks in away from Hughes minutes so far this season. One player who has controlled more than 50% of shot attempts while not with Quinn Hughes on the ice. Who is it?
Will I guess it or no?
I think you have a chance.
I mean, my gut first guess would be Connor Garland, but I'm going to go with Pugh Suter.
Incorrect. Those guys are in the top five in this category. It is Erik Brännström, who has, without Quinn Hughes, has controlled 56% of shot attempts. No one else is above 50. Connor Garland's at 48. Pugh Suter's at 48 as well. So they're close to breaking even. That's it. It's Erik Brännström. He's the only guy where the Canucks have been able to clearly control play absent Quinn Hughes on the ice so far, right? You look at Elias Pettersson, it's like 37%. JT Miller, 37%, something like that, right? Like all of the other guys, even, you know, Teddy Bluger, who I've been really high on this year, 43% without Quinn Hughes in terms of shot attempt share. Connor Garland, fine, 48, but not elite. Not something you'd look at and say, like, oh, that guy's really controlling play unless he's on the ice with Quinn Hughes. Erik Brännström, the only other guy who's doing it. There you go.
yeah, you know, this team's attempted evolution into being a more, you know, attacking-oriented club, I think does require some puck-moving defenders to feed it, right? And mm-hmm. this was something we've talked about a little bit, that when you watch this team play, it almost feels like two separate thoughts. There's the thought on defense where let's erect, you know, essentially erect a forest in front of the net,
yep.
and count on the Ents to prevent teams from getting inside. And I think that made a ton of sense with how this team played a composed, controlled, low-risk style last season. But if you want to get out and fly, you kind of need defenders that can fly with you, like that can seize fourth man's ice, that can get the puck moving vertically. And it just almost feels like you have those Hughes minutes and Hronek, obviously. And then you right now you have the Brännström minutes. And it's been such a welcome balm since Brännström got into the lineup versus what it looked like in the first four games. And then you've got the second pair that just hasn't been able to get out of their own end of the rink. And we know what Soucy and Myers can do. We know that they're valuable contributors on this team. But the way that the shot counter is just slanted against the Canucks every time they're out right now, it's damaging. Like it hasn't cost the team results yet, but you'd expect it to if something doesn't flip.
Really hard way to live, to go through a season consistently to the point where it's almost, especially now that Brännström is in the lineup and is helping lift some of those other minutes and float some of those other minutes, like we're referring to it as the non-Hughes minutes. That's accurate given the gravity he has, but it's also kind of getting to be the Soucy Myers minutes now, right? Like it's not just non-Hughes. Yeah, I think you have to look at what's happening in those other minutes too before you kind of chalk up the blame to everyone else on the team. And it's the gap of the drop-off, right? Of course there's going to be a drop-off in quality when you take Quinn Hughes off the ice. He's the Norris Trophy winner. He's the best defenseman in the league right now. But the baseline falls so dramatically, and the fact that even Erik Brännström is giving them a higher baseline right now than they're getting from Soucy Myers, like that's the other part of the equation when we talk about the non-Hughes minutes.
Well, and the shots, it's not just shots, right? So Carson Soucy on the ice this season, 5-on-5, 32 Canucks shots for, 77
yikes.
Opponent shots against, but it's also 3-8 goals, yep. right? Tyler Myers, 48-4, 64 against, but also 5-7, right? So it's not as if, as good as these guys are at playing in their own end, if you spend too much time there,
no, you're going to get burned.
It's the NHL. Everyone else is too good, no matter how solid you are. And I think they've been solid in their own end, but it's insufficient if you're there too often. And for whatever reason, you know, having had a pretty sturdy performance through last season in the playoffs as a pair often. This year it's just felt a little different in the early going, and the club needs to iron it out and control more play with their second pair on the ice, clearly, if they hope to maintain this sort of point pace over the balance.
All right, we'll take a break here. Keep your texts coming in. Lots of good thoughts about the blue line, about the power play, in general, areas where this team can improve. So we'll take some of those in the next segment, and we'll keep an eye out for Rick Talk and Audio as the team wraps up practice at Rogers Arena as well. More Canucks talk on the way here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Let Kubota do your heavy lifting. Visit them online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line as we continue to react to the Canucks' loss last night, overtime loss against the Carolina Hurricanes. not much of a tweak. I was expecting maybe a little bit more changes at practice from Rick Tocchet as his team got on the ice at Rogers Arena today, but we can talk about that. What did you make of the commentary from Rick Tocchet after the game? And I think the one that stands out the most, obviously, is, you know, you, from your, in response to your question, I believe, asking him about the Pettersson Garland Hoglander line and the line, "I didn't like Hoggy at all," and then kind of stops himself short once he got to Elias Pettersson. What was your reaction in real time to kind of hearing that from Rick Tocchet?
I think he just didn't want to throw more gasoline on the fire, and fair enough, that Pettersson fire is exhausting. It's exhausting for me, and you can tell that it's wearing on the player, and by the way, you can tell that it's wearing on the fans. They are straight up.
Well, it's got to be wearing on everyone right now.
Yeah.
Like him, teammates, coach, everyone. The fans, us, it's wearing.
They are, you know, the Rogers Arena crowd is liable to boo Pettersson when he bobbles pucks. Like, that's happened on multiple occasions in the early going this season. I can't think of, you know, not that star players have always had an easy ride in Vancouver. You can ask Pavel Bure or Henrik and Daniel or whomever you'd like. and there's a story there, right? There's at least some level of scar tissue. Mark Messier. I'm just kidding. He deserved it. The fact is, though, is that I can't remember seeing the Vancouver crowd this impatient with an elite player. And not that impatience is like unfounded. This has been a long stretch, but it is notable. Something to remark on. I've never seen the crowd this frustrated with the protracted struggles of a player.
Yeah, and it is so just front and center, right, when you're watching. The closest thing I can remember to it, I don't know if it was ever an in-arena reaction as much, or if it was more like outside, you know, message boards and radio and stuff after the games, but...
Naslund?
No, like Luongo.
Oh, yeah.
There were times where Luongo was struggling and like an iffy goal would go in, and it wasn't like he was unplayable or anything, and he would make other really good saves, but you know what I mean? There's just this like, oh, or like...
That was a mania, though. Like, that was so completely divorced from reality. I mean...
But it feels like... You're right in that the underlying numbers like were always strong for Luongo, right? So it's not
even
like
the underlying, the face value.
No, but you know
numbers.
What I mean. But he was never slumping in actuality like Pettersson is slumping now.
No.
But there was that same kind of...
Luongo was the most consistently elite goaltender. Yeah.
But I think just in that sense of like, oh, here we go again, that did exist for Luongo for fans.
It did.
At certain points.
For sure. Well, especially at the end of seasons, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, Luongo save percentage in Vancouver, 921, 917, 920, 913, 928, 919.
Yeah.
I mean, not 907, but that was a 20-game season during the lockout, and then 917 before he got traded the torts year. I mean.
Yes, and yet.
Good luck. Good luck ever. Like, I think the worst of those seasons... Okay, the worst Luongo season from a save percentage perspective, you know, you have like a 913 in there, right? That's higher than Thatcher Demko's career save percentage. Okay, like just Thatcher Demko since he became Vancouver's starter. So since he wrested the job from Braden Holtby, 915, 915, 918. Now, granted, save percentage has decreased somewhat.
Yes.
But even relative to league average, right? I mean, you're talking about totally different echelons of performance and consistency. And think about the way that we talk about Demko healthy versus the way Luongo was talked about. Like, that was a mania. That was... And there definitely weren't the Bronx... Felt like Luongo was divisive.
Yeah, that's what I think. I don't think it was in the arena as much.
No, and fundamentally, like, on the streets of Vancouver during the 2010 Olympics, right? You know, when Brodeur cost Canada that game against the United States, like, there were Luongo chants. Like, people wanted to see Luongo play for Canada and on and on. So, I don't know. I even think that one's materially different. I think Rick Tocchet was just reluctant to throw more fuel on the fire. But as he noted, right, like, I made the change, so you kind of know.
There's something going on there, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, that line got fourth line minutes for most of the game, and then got split in the third period and their minutes ticked up a bit. So obviously from the change that Tocchet made, he sort of considered his options and decided that really it was Hoglander that needed to sort of go down lineup as opposed to something more dramatic with Pettersson or with Garland. I like that. I've liked what we've seen from Garland and Pettersson. I would love to see Hoglander have a little bit more leash, but you understand too that Hoglander's still building that foundation of trust that Garland has long since built, right? And that obviously Pettersson's got a different level of rope, because getting him back, you know, to doing Pettersson stuff is kind of the ball game for this team. If you're gonna win a cup this year, you know, you need
him to be really good.
You need him, you know, shooting Godzilla lasers out of his eyes the way he has for most of his career, but certainly hasn't for the last 41 regular season games plus 13 in the playoffs.
And this text comes in about the kind of reaction in the building to Pettersson. He says, "We've never seen this sort of mystery decline in one of our stars. That's why." And that's fair.
It is absolutely fair.
And so much of this conversation is it all comes back to Pettersson's performance, right? Like, that's the root of this. That's the thing that solves all of these kind of meta issues around it, right?
And the fact that we don't understand what's going on. I mean, we think there's probably
no one easy answer to point to.
No, and there's probably a tendonitis issue to some extent. I mean, there is data. The NHL Edge data, as Patrick Johnston pointed out in the province, is down, right? His skating speed is down, or his burst appears to be down. But that feels insufficient to fully explain it. So, you know, you get into all sorts of different speculation. And I'd add this, Pettersson hasn't offered much in terms of insight into how he's thinking about it. And then there's been, you know, wild speculation in prominent local and national reporters sort of about the situation in general that has just added fire to the mystery and the conversation. I think Rick Tocchet was just reluctant to add anything to that, right? He was trying to deprive that particular conflagration of oxygen, and fair enough.
All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, and this text came in from Jay in Calgary, who says, "Why did management think they just needed tall defenders? It feels like they could easily have sacrificed some forward depth. Maybe Myers or Desharnais used that space on a puck mover on the second pair. I really don't get why the offseason was handled the way it was, but Rutherford and Alvin have the benefit of the doubt." And he wonders, was it just buying too much into their ability to help these defensemen because of Myers' improved performance last year? He says it's very confounding now. And it's a fair question.
It is a fair question.
It's a very fair question, especially the one that stands out to me is the Desharnais deal, right? And Desharnais got more money than Teddy Bluger, right? He got more money than Kiefer Sherwood. He got $2 million per season over 2 years. That's a pretty sizable commitment for someone you're explicitly billing as a project, right? Now, maybe the consideration is, the calculation is that the upside outweighs the risk.
And the consideration is giant right-handed defenseman, right? Like, there's, at the end of the day, it's a supply and demand equation more than it's anything else. You want to land that guy, that's what it costs. And the Canucks decided they wanted to land that guy. But, you know, one thing I will say, because I do think it's fair to ask whether or not the Canucks, you know, bought their own BS, right? Like, bought their own ability to structure the game in such a way that it would make things predictable and create an environment where, you know, a forest of giant defenders could move the puck sufficiently well. Or at least could move the puck well enough, given that you had Quinn Hughes and Phil Peronic on your top pair. And, you know, for all that I think that that's a fair observation or a fair critique, I also do think that the organization's self-awareness that, hey, look, we need answers on the blue line. We're not going to commit a bunch of resources and cap space to it. You know, we've already done our big defenseman trade when we paid heavily, right? Retail value, arguably, even in the organization's own sort of recollection or storytelling that they do regarding the Filip Peronic trade, like, we were willing to overpay for the right piece would be something that internally the organization would cop to.
Well, right? That's kind of a hallmark of Jim Rutherford.
Totally. You can't be scared of overpaying. You don't want to sit there in January, right? And be like, man, thank goodness we didn't pay
thank goodness we still have that second round pick.
Yeah. Thank goodness we didn't pay retail price for that player who could help us now. Oh, we're going to miss the playoffs.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the sin. The sin isn't the overpayment. If the fit is right, add your guy. So you know, I do think, though, given that the Canucks weren't going to spend a ton of resources there and, you know, weren't going to match, for example, the term and treasure that Boston handed to Nikita Zadorov, given that they were willing to take a step back in terms of the on-paper quality of their back end, you know, a bet like Desharnais, seeing if you could get more out of him, right? I think tracks with that. And I think the organization's open-mindedness to the fact that, hey, this is an experiment and we'll have to reevaluate. And if it's not going to work, we might have to change the way we play. We might have to, you know, scale back in terms of certain systems things.
Mm-hmm.
We may have to consider other options, or we may have to very aggressively gauge the trade market for potential top six fits or top four fits,
yep.
Excuse me, which the organization's doing. Now, supply and demand, as we talked about,
very tricky issue.
Very tricky.
Yeah.
Every team, like now you're hearing reports too that the Edmonton Oilers have stepped up their pursuit of a top four defenseman. We hear Montreal's in the market.
Uh-huh.
I mean, playoff teams and non-playoff teams alike are after these players. Very few teams are like, even a team like the Calgary Flames that you might have considered a possible, you know, shop for these types of players aren't exactly going to be looking at their team at the moment and saying, hey, we're out of it.
Yeah, so, and the teams that are clearly kind of, well, you can kiss this season goodbye, it's like, guess what? They don't have a lot of good players on them.
Yep.
It's like, who are you rating the San Jose Sharks for that's going to move the needle for you, right?
Ferraro? No, I mean,
Is that a guy you get out,
you
jump the market for, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it was an example to prove your point.
Yeah.
And so, Jan Ruda? Can I interest you in a gently used Jan Ruda? Yeah, actually, kind of.
Now that you mention it.
So this is going to be challenging, but I do think at the very least, you know, as much as I think it's fair to wonder how much the organization bought their own publicity in terms of the impact that their structural game had on some defensemen, I do think it's worth noting that, you know, at the very least, there was an element to which the organization hedged. The organization understood that
yes.
they were taking a swing. The organization understood that they might have to reevaluate it in midstream. And the organization went into this season fully aware that the team they were icing in the month of October was not going to be the finished product
yep.
that they were intending to ice come April and May, when the stakes are highest and when this team's ambitions can actually be realized or not.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the idea of kind of doubling down on what worked for them last year, because you could definitely say that's what they did on the blue line. Up front, it was a different story in the offseason, right? And you've talked about it, how they had a very, you know, they really wanted to change their philosophy, bring in more speed, find guys who could create more off the rush. That's where they allocated a lot of their resources in the summer. And I think the question now for me on the blue line is, as you said, look, we kind of understood this was one potential outcome. And I think, as you say, the organization understood that this was one potential outcome, where we'd be at this point in the season asking some pretty serious questions about the level of puck moving from this group.
Can you imagine, too, the questions that we'd be asking if not for Kevin Lankinen?
Oh, the defensive questions?
Oh, man.
Yes, it would be. There'd be a lot of them, a lot more than there are already. And I guess the question for me is, okay, the project with Vincent Desharnais, like, what does that look like in practice now that we're in season, right? How much can we realistically expect that to improve? What are the tactical tweaks they can do to maybe put their defensemen in a better position to succeed? And then can they, and how early can they find an upgrade externally? Because we can talk about, okay, how do you move people around in the, you know, in the defense pairs and all that, and this text comes in, can we just put our two top paid D-men on separate lines? Hronek should be able, but should also be expected to run and control a defensive pair on his own. We have defensive depth to some degree, but you have two puck movers stuck playing with each other. I do wonder if at some point you have to bite the bullet and at least try Hronek away from Hughes for a certain point. But then I also look at what the pairings that would result from that, right? And do I have a ton of confidence that a Hronek-Soucy pairing and a Myers-Hughes pairing is all of a sudden going to really dramatically change what we're seeing? Not really. So, look, should you try that at some point? Yeah, probably. But I'm also pretty convinced that the solutions are going to be external more than anything else, more than moving, shuffling the pieces you already have around.
If you think that's the right call, then it's on you to go explain it to Quinn.
Yep.
Like, if you're a fan suggesting this, consider what your response is when you go
when
in to Quinn tell
Hughes
Quinn
says no,
and Quinn looks at you and says, nah,
no, I don't want to.
No,
That would be a great fan contest.
It's like, or how about I keep winning you games? How about that? How about that, guys?
I mean, I just want to see that contest now. The Canucks run that contest. Convince fans. Convince Quinn Hughes to try a different partner other than Philip Roenick.
Yeah.
See how it goes.
And go have that conversation with him while his brothers are in town. That's really the play. Come on.
Well, it doesn't have to happen next game necessarily.
Yeah, no kidding.
All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, and lots of good thoughts coming in. Somebody else agrees with you. Without Lankin and last night, the narrative today is totally different. Yes, Quinn Hughes is awesome, but the game easily could have been 5-1 or more going into the third if not for Lankin and some lucky bounces.
Easily.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think it's interesting because last night felt like one of the most fortunate results of the Canucks season, and yet on balance, even though the Canucks still have some like percentage stuff in their favor, they're converting on a high clip at 5-on-5. Their save percentage is good 5-on-5. It's not unsustainably good, at least if Lankinen can keep this level of play up. Maybe unsustainably good on the penalty kill, actually. Anyway, I really do feel like the Canucks have had a fair bit of misfortune in the early going. I feel like a lot of the stuff we talked about in the context of the Rutherfordian, we're a playoff team if everything goes our way context, right?
Yep.
We talked a lot about margin for error and this team having margin for error this year. I look through it and a lot of this team's most important engines, I think, are either firing at a lower level than we should have reasonably expected, Pettersson and Miller in particular, or are offline indefinitely for a longer period than we probably reasonably expected coming into this season in Thatcher Demko. And the team still got points in all but one of their games. I mean, that's actually wildly impressive and I think a testament in some ways to what this team's ceiling actually could be if things, you know, sort of stabilize in terms of some of their best players and certainly in terms of the health of their star netminder.
Oh, there's no doubt about it that you can see the potential there, right? Mm-hmm. If JT Miller is fully healthy and really clicking at the top of his game, obviously if Elias Pettersson, the number one thing, if that sorts itself out in some way, right? If he is a consistent difference maker for this team, like as you said, what, they have 11 points in 8 games and that just, he hasn't been close. They're surviving. They're in the mix to win the Pacific. They're more than surviving. If all of a sudden you get another superstar level contribution, like we know he's capable of, yeah, that's why people should be hyped about this team. It's just, it's like the question is like how long before you start to really downgrade the prospects of that coming through? And I'm not there, but I understand why fans are getting antsy with it, right?
Yeah. Well, for sure. I mean, it's a 41 game stretch where he's performed as like a 60 point forward. And I guess it could be even more anemic than that if you want to factor in the playoffs, which I think a lot of fans do. You know, and as much as I insist that I believe that it's looked different over the course of this season than it did down the stretch, you know, games like last night where you're playing an elite opponent and Pettersson's ice time gets cut, you know, and I think he was certainly a part of the club's power play struggles. I mean,
well, and I think his play took a clear step back, I thought, from where it was in the little kind of, you know, 3 or 4 games baby step stretch. And that's frustrating, not being able to build on, hey, you scored the goal, you've been taking these steps forward, you want to see that trajectory continue, right? And maybe it's not back to square one, but it that's what it kind of feels like when you don't see that consistent trajectory.
Yeah, and all of that said, I do think it's worth noting that, you know, this team is to some extent buttering their bread in terms of which top six forward line gets, like they're buttering their own bread, excuse me, with which top six forward line gets to play with Hughes Hronek, right? And for the most part, it's been Miller. I mean,
what kind of bread?
Miller's averaging over 2 minutes extra per game, 17 more minutes than Quinn Hughes, with Quinn Hughes, 5-on-5 than Pettersson is this season, right? So there's a clear sort of preference for that five-man unit with Besser and Miller, as opposed to putting it out there with Pettersson. And given what happens to every other Canucks player when they're away from Hughes, you know, those sort of minutes the shot counter caves in on the Canucks, right? So if you're feeding Pettersson into those non-Hughes minutes, which worked for this team last year, in part because I think when Pettersson was driving the way he was at the start of last season, he was actually able to insulate those non-Hughes minutes.
It's a great theory if Pettersson's playing up to his capabilities.
Totally.
Right? It's like, okay, we'll have the one elite driver, Quinn Hughes, out there for large parts of the game, and then we'll have Elias Pettersson out there for large parts of the game. Awesome.
But when he's not driving, you know, the obvious corollary, right? Those minutes can start to look a little specious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we're seeing here.
Yeah, somebody texted in earlier about kind of that split. And it's not, as you said, what, about 2 minutes extra a game for JT Miller with Quinn Hughes? I think on the season, JT Miller's played about 61 minutes, 5-on-5 with Quinn Hughes, Elias Pettersson about 45. So not a massive gap, right? But you know, roughly 2 minutes a game. And it does add up over the course of a season.
Last night. Right.
Yeah.
12 minutes or like 11 and a half minutes for Pettersson, for Miller with Hughes. And, you know, it was like three, right? As Pettersson played much more frequently with Erik Brännström, and as good as Erik Brännström's playing, right? I think we all understand the drop off there.
Yes, absolutely. He is not Quinn Hughes. And Brandon in Vancouver phrases it this way. Big picture question. If I told you a team would go 600 in the games where Demko is injured, would you take it before the season?
Of course.
A lot of people would. Now, the caveat is also how many games did people think Demko would be missing, right? Because going 600 for the first, you know, eight games to start the season is a lot different than if it's like stretching on month after month, right? And you're going 600. So that changes the math a little bit on that one. But yeah, if you had offered people this start without Thatcher Demko, they absolutely would have taken it for the Canucks. 650 again, the Dunbar Lumber text line. And this one came in earlier, and I just wanted to mention it because we spend a lot of time talking about the guys who should be the engines of this team, right? And obviously Quinn Hughes is number one, and then you have Elias Pettersson and JT Miller and Thatcher Demko as the kind of pillars of the team. And somebody texted in, what about Besser? Why is he always kept out of the core engines of the list of core engines for this team? And I think, you know, Besser is having a really nice start to the season. He's scoring goals. He's still clicking with JT Miller. But even when you see Brock Besser going through these really positive stretches, I think he fits in more as a complementary player to a driver rather than somebody who is going to drive play on his own. And that's not to denigrate him. It's really important to have high-end complementary players who can help out your play drivers and can finish the plays they're creating. But it's just different than being an engine for the team. Don't get me wrong. They need Brock Besser to be really good. It's just he's in a different category.
Yeah, and I think that's right. But also, I do think Brock Besser could drive down lineup.
Sure.
You know, I think we haven't seen him really ever play. First of all, we don't tend to view wingers as drivers, right? There's few wingers that tend to drive. And if we do view them as drivers, we tend to view them as drivers down lineup, right? Guys like Garland who play on a third line, and it's a little bit different. It's like, hey, that's a top line player on the third line. He can drive play in that role.
Yeah, although I mean, like at the very top end of the league, obviously there's lots of exceptions. You know, Pastrnak and the truly elite guys.
Sure, but even then, we're more looking at a guy like Pat Pastrnak as a guy who drives offense.
Sure.
You know, he also drives play, right? Marner would be like sort of an engine type guy, but you know, those are wingers that play like centermen, right? Like wingers who are puck dominant through the neutral zone. And it's just a little bit different. We talk a little bit less about top of the lineup wingers. Unless you're really puck dominant through the neutral zone, we just don't tend to view you or talk about you as a driver.
Mm-hmm.
But Besser, in those minutes where he has played down lineup, like when he used to play with Adam Gaudette and stuff like that on the third line, he did drive. I mean, he was super successful helping the Canucks control play at a higher clip than they otherwise would when he was played down lineup. But for the most part, he's been glued to Miller or Pettersson or whatever. So in some ways, he's a driver of offense. He's a matchup capable top of the lineup winger.
Mm-hmm.
But we just don't tend to regard him as a driver, which isn't to say he can't.
It's just not really his job on the team. That's not what they're asking him to do. That's not the role they're putting him in, and that's fine. He's doing his role really, really well.
And again, he's just not a puck-dominant winger, so we talk about him a little bit differently.
All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Final segment of the show coming up here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Strantz here, live from the Kintec Studio 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber and Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at DunbarLumber.com. There is a fresh batch of Rick Tocchet audio that has just come into our inboxes. So we'll get that turned around ASAP here and hear from Rick Tocchet after practice today. And, of course, a lot of interest in Canucks practice today after what Rick Tocchet had to say post-game last night. Now, just before we get to Tocchet, this question came in from Devin from the Yukon. Shout out to our Yukon listeners holding it down. He says, did last night's game change the narrative about who comes out of the lineup when Dakota Joshua is back? I don't know if it necessarily changes things about who comes out of the lineup, because you could look at this a couple of different ways, right? Hoglander sliding down to the fourth line, Arshdeep Bains going up with Elias Pettersson and Connor Garland. I think prior to last night, you probably would have said Arshdeep Bains, the most likely guy to come out of the lineup in favor of Dakota Joshua, maybe Daniel Sprong. Now, all of a sudden, Bains is moving up to the top six, so I don't know if he's still a candidate. It would feel pretty harsh for Hoglander to come out of the lineup. If anything, what it does, I think it makes it easier to reunite Dakota Joshua with Connor Garland, right, if these lines hold. And it doesn't seem like, based on what Rick Tocchet said yesterday, that Joshua will be an option for tomorrow's game, but potentially Saturday against the Sharks. So I think it probably makes it easier, a little easier, to figure out where to put him in the lineup, potentially on a line with Pettersson and Garland, but not necessarily easier to figure out who's coming out when Dakota Joshua is back in. But it does kind of remind you, like we said yesterday, you know, the questions of what are they going to do when Joshua is back? Well, things happen. Now, it wasn't an injury or anything, but performances, all of those things, guys get shuffled around the lineup, and all of a sudden, it changes the conversation in a big way.
Yeah, things change rapidly over the course of a full hockey season. And, you know, last night was a reminder, right? The prevailing trend line of the moment does not guarantee anything in this league, right? Even Kevin Lankinen, right, sort of as a prominent example at the moment, rolling along at a 920 save percentage, down from 930, down from 950.
Down from like 950, yep.
Right, so he's trending back toward a career average that's closer to 910, 906, right, in that more pedestrian, solid 1B option kind of range. Right now, it feels like he's completely locked in as this team's starter, but you're only a game or two away ever from the narrative completely flipping, not to mention the possibility of other circumstances intervening. So a reminder that things change quickly in this league, especially when it comes to lineups and yes, positions for non-elite players.
Right, yeah, when you haven't built up that level of trust and that kind of, you know, even Hoglander like signed the extension, right? So there is an investment, but it doesn't make him impervious from potential consequences, from sliding down the lineup, from all of those things, right? You have to be at a very, very special tier of ability, of salary to really protect yourselves long-term from those types of consequences. I still think it would be a big surprise for Hoglander to come out of the lineup at this point, right? Considering how well he played early in the season and how much talk it has praised him going back to training camp in Penticton. But again, as you said, things change quickly, and even guys who are playing very well, sometimes stuff like that happens. So I think still very much an open question on who comes out of a lineup when Dakota Joshua is healthy, but there is that spot now next to Pettersson and Garland that looks pretty interesting for him to slot into when he's good to go.
And Dakota Joshua Garland is a fixture.
That's the thing, right?
Right?
And I do, like, maybe I was naive to think that Tocchet would be reluctant to split up the Hoglander-Pettersson-Garland line if it was clicking, but now that you're already splitting them up and you like Joshua and Garland as a duo, and he's name-checked that repeatedly as like kind of one of their fixture duos in the lineup, it seems pretty easy, pretty logical just to go back to that. And how many texts have we got in over the last 6 months about, hey, do you try PD with Joshua and Garland?
It basically leaves you with the top six that you rolled into in the playoffs last year, except with Pettersson bumping up to take Lindholm's spot, with Lindholm having departed, and DeBrusk representing something of a first-line upgrade over Pugh Suter.
Yep.
That's it. So it's not even a line combination that is foreign or that's outside the realm of something we've basically seen and saw for a long time in this club's highest leverage games last year.
Yep. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Still getting that Rick Tocchet audio turned around. Hopefully that will be ready momentarily here. But lots of texts, lots of thoughts coming in. This one might be a little bit of a bigger question than we can answer in just a couple of minutes here. But Ryan on the road says, should we not be worried big picture about Demko's situation? Actually, I won't even get into that. We can save that for another episode because, yeah, the Demko situation is
a huge subject
to
unpack
and a pretty big subject to get into. So instead of doing that, let's hear from Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet.
Yeah, I think more, like you said, more minutes. I think there is the trust factor because I think his game has been coming. You know, he has that ability to skate the puck out and make that, you know, that one pass breakout. So, and I think even the offensive, and I think he's going to even get more comfortable. So, yeah, I think we got to start chipping away and get some more ice time.
You sounded like a guy at the podium last night that maybe was contemplating significant changes at practice this morning, and yet pretty much status quo. Sleep on it and decide to come back with sort of the same group?
Well, there might be a D change. Not sure. Maybe Jules gets in. I don't know if Forsey's ready yet. I want to give the, I think I put Hoggy with Suits and Spronger. Actually, I didn't think they were that bad when I switched it. So, I don't want to overreact. I think we know we had to improve on a few things. I don't want to go too crazy with too many changes.
Gains up on merit, obviously.
Yeah, I think with Hoggy, sometimes when you play him up there, you know, he's fine. Hoggy's played really well for me. Sorry, guys. And I think sometimes he needs to, you know, he's got to get back to who he was, you know, sometimes. And I think just that switch, I could switch him back. I mean, in game, it's not forever. But yeah.
Rick, the overtime goal last night, was that just a case of puck watching? Like, was it as simple as guys just kind of got locked on?
Yeah, I think, JT let the guy, he was going to block the shot. The coverage obviously wasn't good. I don't think we touched the puck, so. Unfortunately, we've lost three games in overtime. But, you know, we've got points in our last seven or eight games. So there is some positives. We've set ourselves up here, with getting those points.
You talk a lot about protecting the guts of the ice. You had a couple of track meets with the Devils last year, including the one here. With a guy like Keyshire, who's got 9 goals, what do you have to do tomorrow just to make sure that you're tighter?
We've got to reload. I mean, you saw the goals that we gave up Carolina. They're odd man. We're giving them odd man rushes. So something that we were really good last year. So that was one of our focus in the video today was, you have to reload. I think we're waiting on if the guy's going to win a battle or not. If it's a 50-50 puck, you got to be above people. So we'll get back to it.
Rick, you started the Bluger line in all three periods yesterday. Just curious, that line, how have they developed an identity, and what are you seeing from that trio that you're really liking?
Yeah, I just think sometimes matchup-wise, they can go against the other team's, best lines, and that leaves PD and sometimes Millsy and the other lines for the their third and fourth line. So if we can get Teddy's line, which they've done a nice job of checking, that it should give us our best players some mismatches, so that's what we're looking for.
And just defensively with that line, they've done such a good job of limiting high danger chances against. Is it just about the trio that the three players understand the defensive zone, or what is it about that line?
Well, they're pretty responsible. They reload. They stop in the slot and they protect the slot. So they're doing the stuff that we all four lines have to do.
Rick, going back to the start of last year, you guys have been one of the best teams in the NHL. When the game goes into overtime, I think you guys only won 7 of 19. What do you think is up with that?
Yeah, we talked about strategy about 2-3 weeks ago. I think honestly, it's blown coverages and it's execution. And you can't be out there when you're tired. That's why when you can safely get off after 30 seconds, you got to get off. Because once you're tired on 3-on-3, that's when you make those mistakes. So I think there's a combination of stuff. We definitely have to have another meeting on it because. In the Florida game, we actually had a set play when Millsy scored. We caught one of their guys flat-footed, which is good. But we just got to make sure that we got to know where we're going when we don't have the puck.
Sherwood, 9 hits last night. He's on pace for 600 this year, which would smash the record by a lot. what have you noticed about him, and have you seen a player go on this type of hitting run in your career as a player or coach?
Yeah, I just remember when I played back in Philly, those Philly days, we had a team that hit a lot, and it's contagious, right? And he's an old school guy. You know, he goes through people. And it's not that you have to kill a guy. I think that he goes through people, or he's on his check, and it makes it difficult. You know, nobody wants to play against the guy. When he's on the ice, it's like they're looking around, and he's hard to play against. And I think we got to get more of that from some of our guys. And you know, we'll work on it.
Do you have anything new on Joshua, or is it just another day of practice and another step in the right
direction? Yeah, I think he went and saw the doctor with something, but I think he's getting close to being like pain free.
When you talked last night about the power play, you mentioned those guys having to work harder.
Yeah.
Shouldn't that be the baseline?
Yeah. You know, I got Yogi to do it, and his presentation, his stuff has been outstanding. So if you can't, I mean, it's got nothing to do with coaching. You know, he's done an unreal job. Like, he's given him some really good structure. I really believe it's now the intensity, the awareness, things like that. So that's the boxes that the guys are going to have to check right now. Is it basic? Sometimes when you're talented, you think you can just skill your way, and that doesn't work. So, you know, we just got to, you know, it's not horrible. I think we're 20%, but it's not a good taste. We don't have a good taste in our mouth with it. So, but they don't either. Trust me. So I think it's more of beating your man to the your check, coming up with those loose pucks. I think somebody told me, Alex, I think we're one of the worst teams at picking off like rims. Like, you know, those are possession plays that we need to do. You know, we have the guys that can do it. We just got to make sure that we're more intense when we do it.
Do you think when you have those guys have the puck, they need to be aggressive in getting to the net?
Like, well, if you beat pressure, you got to attack. I mean, there's no point to look for a play. I mean, that's the one thing we weren't good at last year, you know, is goals off chaos plays, you know, where, yeah, we were good at set plays, but we weren't good off chaos plays where, you know, it's not even a play. It's, you know, you beat your guys out of the corner, you take it to the net, you score a goal. I think we got to get better at that, and that's a mentality, and we, you know, we're working on that every day.
What about entries on the power play? What are you seeing?
Yeah, well, we're going to change a couple of things. A couple of guys might bring the puck up with some different guys, but that's supporting the puck and that speed. It's the same thing, and it's not. You know, we knew what Carolina was going to do. They're going to stack the one side, and some reason we stick handled to that side, and then we got stripped. So, you know, you give them the information, then you got to make sure that you apply it. So, yeah, no, but we'll work on it. I mean, the guys had a good practice day for it too.
One element we don't see much of on the power play is Petey's one timer, and like he has scored in this league with that as a weapon. Is that on him to find opportunities, or is it philosophical that you're just working on the left side and it's not getting to him in those shooting positions?
Well, I mean, you can't stand still, and the team's not going to let you take one timer, so you got to move. And then you got to move whatever the structure is and then get it back, then when you should be open. So it's a lot of movement. You know, and I think we've been on, talked to Petey about moving his feet. You can't just stand still. It's like Ovechkin. He used to score a ton of power play goals on that one side, right? And now teams are taking that away. Now you got to do something different. So, yeah, I know everybody wants the one-timer, but it's not there. If you got to move your feet to find other ways. So that's really what it comes down to.
Rick, it feels like it's been a while since we asked you about how Thatcher Demko's doing.
I think he's had like four really good days. I can tell you that. So, which is good. It was, I think when you have a guy out, you know, when he starts to feel good, he stacks some consecutive days together. That's a really good thing. So that's positive.
What does it say about how well Lankanen's playing that we're not asking you about Demko all the time right now?
Yeah, I just think Lanks is a, you know, like I said to you guys, I didn't know who he was, but he's just strung game after game of good efforts. Like even in, like I said, in training camp, he missed a week or something of training camp. So he's locked in, even in practice. He's not too high. I mean, he's on a bit of a roll. Like, if you talk to him, he's a very humble guy. You know, he's thankful for the opportunity, grateful for the opportunity, so he's not taking it for granted. So you got to root for a kid like that.
She lost maybe Saturday?
I haven't even decided tomorrow, so we'll see.
Langdon seems really cerebral. Like, he's a real thinker of the game. Is that a correct assessment there?
Yeah, yeah. I think when you talk to him about even, like, he wants to talk about our breakouts, you know, like, he's good at stopping rims. Like, you know, he thinks every aspect of the game. He's worked really hard. But, yeah, no, he's a student of the game. I think I was here earlier this morning. He was in already with Marco and them doing a video. I mean, that's the way he is.
I just want to ask you, you mentioned Josh was close to being pain-free. I mean, can we get a sense of maybe when he'll return to play?
I don't know the exact date, but it's, like, it's getting close. I mean, you know, I haven't even talked to him today. But, yeah, we got to get him on a line where he's going to get – I think he took some line rushes and got in there, and our practice wasn't that long, but he needs to get some, like, three-on-three stuff down low, pushing and shoving, and he's been doing that last couple of days.
Rick, will you have to ramp him up, though? Like, this is a guy that was a big part of your penalty kill last year when he was on his game. Like, coming off this sort of situation and playing catch-up, like, do you have to – sort of easy guy in a little bit?
I think so. I think you got to manage his minutes. I think you got to make him feel comfortable in certain situations. You know, it's obviously a shock that what happened, and that I think he's really dealt with it really well. But I think it's important that he just gets in the mix with the team. But you know, Dakota's a guy that you know, he plays all positions, right? I mean, in the sense that plays power play. Sometimes he's penalty killer for us. So, you know, but I have to manage his minutes. Yeah.
Is there a temptation to put him back with Bluger and Bonner just to get some familiarity at the outset?
I don't know. I mean, that line's really good, Teddy. I think Josh could go anywhere and fit. You know, you got a two-way guy that goes to the net. He should be a pretty easy guy to play with. I know Garz likes playing with him.
Yeah. You mentioned it the other day. Could part of that ramp-up process for him be going down on a conditioning stint to Abbotsford?
Yeah, you know, we kind of briefly talked about it. And I'll be honest with you, I have not personally talked to him about it, so I'll talk to him about it, see what he thinks about that. I like talking to the player about that, but you know, for me, maybe it's just like get him in the lineup here and get him with the team and get going.
So that's Rick Tocchet after practice today for the Canucks, and just a final few minutes here on the show, but lots to unpack as always from Rick Tocchet. Health update. He says that Demko has had four really good days, says he's stacking some consecutive good days together, which is a good sign. And I know Rick Tocchet has kind of mentioned in the past that hasn't been happening with Thatcher Demko. So, you know, take that for what it's worth, that he is getting, as Tocchet says, those good days in consecutively. But I think until we start to see, you know, more than just those updates, but the actual tangible signs of progress, it's still going to be a pretty mysterious situation with Thatcher Demko. And then the commentary on the power play really stands out to me as well, right? Because, you know, he goes out of his way to vouch for the coaching side of things, right? With, of course, new power play coach Yogi Shevkovsky, who's taking it over. And Tocchet says, quote, it has nothing to do with coaching. He's given them a good structure. Now it's about intensity, awareness. Sometimes when you're talented, you think you can just skill it, but it doesn't work like that. And again, pretty pointed commentary about guys who are this team's best players, right? Quinn Hughes, Elias Pettersson, JT Miller, Brock Besser, and even throw Connor Garland in there. And he's not limiting it to criticism of one player, saying that unit as a whole not bringing that intensity that they need to have. And then he did go into detail on one player as well in response to a question about Elias Pettersson's one-timer and just the how rarely we see that now on the power play. And as Tocchet says, well, look, you can't stand still. You got to move. You got to get open. He says, again, a common refrain for Tocchet. We've talked to Petey about moving his feet. You can't just stand still. Everyone wants to see the one-timer, but it's not there. You got to move your feet and find something else. So on Elias Pettersson individually, on the power play unit as a whole, some pretty pointed commentary from Rick Tocchet after practice today.
Yeah. And I mean, if we sort of look at it and think about the Canucks across the last two seasons, right? 22% in the time that, you know, after Jason King departed, right? So Jason King came in and started running the power play after Newell Brown was dismissed, and for the second time, because that's happened multiple times. But yeah, so in 2021, the Canucks parted ways with Newell Brown after that miserable, you know, lockout or pandemic abbreviated 56 game campaign, and 23.1% in his two seasons, 22.4. So, I mean, it's not like it's taken a step back, although I would say this year that attempt rate is genuinely disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go further than concerning. We know that this team has the talent, the baseline understanding between Vancouver's best players from years back, right? This group found that groove during the 2019-20 season, and four of the five guys that factored in a major way
still here
into that power play are still here. So in some ways, you should be almost beginning to get that consistency, stability, continuity bump as you go, right? The Rangers have got, that the Washington Capitals got once upon a time, that the Sedins and Kessler had once upon a time. And for whatever reason, it just feels like it's been stagnant. It feels like this club's been sort of perched outside the top 10 or just inside the top 10, somewhere like the 9th to 11th best power play. But when you read out the names on paper, it feels like they should be able to do more. I would add this.
And now it looks like it's in danger of regressing way beyond that, too.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
If the attempt rate stays this low, this team's not going to finish with an above-average power play percentage unless they get extraordinarily lucky finishing over the balance of the campaign, which, hey, I'm never going to put that past this group. But you don't want to be in a spot where you need a bounce to get a power play goal. And right now, with the way that this Canucks team's executing 5-on-4, that's how it feels watching them.
Yeah, it's no surprise that Rick Tocchet putting it out there, right, and questioning and pointing to the effort of that five-man unit right now, because it is a glaring area for concern for the Vancouver Canucks. And look, hey, Rick Tocchet also said they had a good practice. He's got a lot of confidence in them, but that's going to continue to be a major talking point here until they figure it out.
It's a good team. The sky's not falling, but there were certainly some elements in that game last night. When you're coming out of a game and you feel fortunate to have gotten a point, that speaks volumes about where the level of performance was at. And to a man, every Canucks player who spoke in that locker room postgame noted that Kevin Lankinen had effectively stolen them a point.
They're back at it tomorrow. They'll play the Devils. We'll be here. It's a crossover Wednesday. Jason Bukalo will join us. Always a fun show on a Wednesday. Thanks for listening here to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.